This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Season 5, Episode 23 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And Max is not here tonight. We thought he was here, but then the person who was here ripped off their face, and it turned out to be, well, it was actually my cat. And now he's in the corner sleeping. So, you know, what can you do? But we will forge on ahead and discuss this week's topic, which is part two in our series on Leonard Nimoy, where we are going to be looking at his work as a television star in the only other show which he acted in on a regular basis aside from Star Trek, like not as a guest starring role, but where they were like starring, and right. that's Mission Impossible. So
let's give everybody a second to just, now that you said Mission Impossible, get it out of your head, dun 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 dun, and just let it play out, and now we can go on.
It's not going to get out of your head. It just got in my head, and it's not going to leave until probably I'm done editing this thing. So,
probably.
So yeah. So Mission Impossible. You know, I mean, most people today, like if you were to ask, you know, your average high schooler, like, "Hey, Mission Impossible," they'd be like, "Yeah, Tom Cruise." But Mission Impossible was a television show. It was two television shows, as a matter of fact, and the first one aired in the 60s and the 70s, and in season 4, when Star Trek had ended, Leonard Nimoy jumped on board Mission Impossible as one of the leads. He played a character named Paris, who was a master of disguise, and he stayed on there for 2 years, seasons 4 and 5. So, John, could you kind of give a description of what Mission Impossible the show was like, kind of plot-wise or whatever?
I'm not sure if I will speak to that self-same high school crowd that identifies with Tom Cruise, but anybody who grew up with the A-Team, it's basically the A-Team before the A-Team, where basically a group of people get handed a task that is supposedly incredibly difficult and hero their way through it. The slight difference being they always had to be put up against a mission from an exploding tape that would tell them that they had to do something insane, like smuggle a scientist out or find the center of a drug ring or keep a murder from happening from a contract killer. And so the whole show is just them trying to stay one step ahead and get out of tight jams until they finally figure out how to win everything at the end.
Yeah, I'm guessing anyone who knows what the A-Team is probably knows what Mission Impossible is.
That's a fair bet. I don't think, I mean, is there anything on TV right now that's really similar, like analogous to Mission Impossible?
Well, I mean, what I would say was, even though it's not on TV anymore, is Alias.
Yes, you're right. Alias would have been in the same vein.
But now that show's like 10 years old, too, more than 10 years old. So, you know, we're old. What can you do?
We are. We're getting up there, man.
Mission Impossible, it started in 1966, same year as Star Trek. It ended in 1973. It was very popular and not tremendously similar to the movies which it has spawned. But good. Nonetheless, I don't know. What do you think about Mission Impossible?
I think that it doesn't hold up over time, but I think that if you make the allowance for the idea that it was the 60s, I mean, you know, one of the shows that I watched for this was the first episode of season 5, The Killer. And it in a sense, it's fun to watch because the entire premise of how they fooled this guy would have been undone by GMAPs. So, like, it's a really interesting historical look back at everything, like phone books or phone booths or, you know, cabs that are kind of becoming pointless now in the app age. You know, it's fun, but I honestly don't think that there's anything that subscribes it outside of nostalgia. I don't think it really stands the test of time. Maybe the first few seasons do, but as it got on, not really.
It's one of those weird things. Like when Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol came out, it was weird because, like, I mean, it's always sort of been this way for me, actually. I can remember when the first Mission Impossible movie came out and I was in high school. I'm like, yeah, this thing's awesome. There's a TV show. Oh, my God. And then I watched like one episode of the show and I'm like, what's this? You know?
Yeah.
And when Ghost Protocol came out and I kind of was more aware of the history and everything like that. And, you know, I was like, you know what? This is on Netflix now. I'm going to check it out, you know? How hard would it be for me to watch all 171 episodes and the 80s series as well before Ghost Protocol comes out? And I started on season one, and I'm like, this is really interesting. You know, and then I got to episode two, and I'm like, this is interesting in the same exact way.
Yeah.
You know? Because the thing about the show is it really... It does what it does really well, but what it does is like the same thing again and again and again.
Yeah.
And I mean, for people who haven't seen the show, but maybe have seen the movies, the best way to describe it would be, you know, the episodes open up with, you know, Mr. Phelps getting his mission, right? And then they immediately jump into it. And it's really just sort of a procedural where they figure out how to do this thing, whether it's, you know, protecting an important person or stealing the plans to a whatever. It's really just sort of a step-by-step procedural of how they're going to do it. It's very similar to any individual sort of like, not necessarily the action sequences in the movie, but sort of the set pieces where they have to do a thing. Like, for example, in Ghost Protocol, when they're at the hotel and they need to transform the room and shut down the server, and, you know, there's complications and it involves people climbing up, you know, skyscrapers or whatever. And it's like, while that is obviously escalated in the movies, that's basically just like a feature film, big budget version of an episode of the show. But like one of those little 10-minute sequences in the movie would be like the entire episode of the show.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Because the concept of pacing was quite different back in the 60s and early 70s.
And, it's true.
You know, to speak to your point about repetition, like, I think we talked about this with regards to something else we looked at one point. But back then, things were really, you know, there was no binge watching. If you missed an episode, see you later. You missed it, period. So you might go 2 weeks without seeing an episode of Mission Impossible. And so, you know, it's whatever night it is of the week. You've had a rough day at work. Your boss is climbing up your back. You just want to sit down with your beer and your cigarette and you want to watch something that's not going to challenge you too much. And there you go. There's Mission Impossible. The good guys do neat things. And okay, it's the same thing, but whatever. That's fun.
Yeah, I mean, just like those sequences in the movies are fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, the difference is that in the movies, and I mean, some people will complain about the writing in those movies. I would not. I think the writing in those movies tends to be really good. But in the movies, those sequences are connected by a story, you know? There's something which is kind of driving the overall plot, in terms of, you know, some sort of meaning or whatever. You know, there's stuff going on with the characters. Whereas here, there's really nothing going on with the characters, aside from maybe like, oh no, they've kidnapped Phelps. Well, we need to get him back because he's Phelps. You know, that sort of thing. But they throw you in. And I mean, part of it, I admire the sort of no nonsense, you know, just like get in there. This is an action series and we're going to, you know, make it full on action suspense for the entire, you know, 50 minutes. Yeah. I mean, it's literally like, you know, here's your mission. You got to do this thing. Why? Doesn't matter, because it's important. Select your team. Okay, there's the team. Everyone's together. Okay, here's how we're going to do it. You do it. You get out. Episode ends. Credits. You know?
Yeah, and the funny thing is that every episode, it's your mission should you choose to accept it. They never once deal with a scenario where he doesn't. And the tape destroys itself. I've always wondered, was there some sort of signal he could give where it'd be like, nah, I don't want to do this one. I'm on vacation this week. He always accepts it. Why do they even bother asking?
It is kind of funny. I mean, they do assume that, you know, like, I think they even did that in one of the episodes that I watched. I know that they do it in Mission Impossible 3 with Billy Crudup, where he's like, your mission, should you choose to accept it? And then he's like, thanks, Ethan, and good luck. You know, like,
yeah,
you know, one of those things, you know, kind of like when you're sending off an email at work and it's like, could you do this? Thanks.
Yeah.
Knowing that.
Yeah. Okay. That's exactly right.
If the person doesn't do it, you know, I think it's kind of one of those things, you know?
Yeah.
It's like a 1960s email or something, but yeah, I mean, I can understand why on a regular basis they didn't ever do that. And I mean, it's kind of a cool little term, you know, I guess to throw in there.
Yeah.
And by throwing it in there, you're sort of, you know, in a way acknowledging that this is so dangerous that they're not even going to make you do it. You know, you have to accept the risk or whatever. But why wasn't there an episode out of 171? Yeah. And maybe there was. I'm sure we're going to get someone who's arguing that there was. It was episode 152. You know, but I mean, why wasn't there an episode where they were just like, you know what, we're not going to do it. And then something terrible happens and they, you know, just when they thought they were out, they get pulled back in, you know?
The entire episode is them doing cleanup because they didn't do something. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Then they send in another team, right? And then you get into the movie territory where it's like, oh, there's a mole inside of IMF, because that's what I think like every movie has been so far. I don't think there's been a single movie where there hasn't been someone either accused of being bad or actually being bad inside of IMF.
But they were bad in IMAX a couple of times in the fourth one. So
that's pretty cool. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. So what about Leonard Nimoy's performance in this thing? Now, he played a character named Paris, who was, from what I understand, a master of disguise, although there were a lot of guys who seemed to be that in the show. And, well, I don't know. I mean, for one thing, it seems that did he take over for Martin Landau? Is that kind of how things went down? Landau left and then they were like, okay, we're bringing in Nimoy. I mean, I guess that's what it was, right?
Yeah. They needed, you know, like you said, it's sort of plug and play. You know, when somebody left the show, they were able to grab someone and put them in that spot. And yeah, I don't know for sure if that's the case, but it would follow because Nimoy has sort of that same distinctive voice and look that, you know, and I don't mean that to be dismissive of, you know, anybody's talent in either way, but you know, TV shows, they want familiarity. And so if they're going to replace a character, they tend to go for, or at least they used to tend to go for somebody that was very similar to, you know, who was established previously.
Yeah, I mean, they were actually going to do that with Nimoy in season two, apparently. You know, they had like a contract dispute and they didn't know if he was coming back, and they had an alternate version of a Muck Time written for like some random other Vulcan who was going to take his place, who was going to be played by the dude who was the other Vulcan male potential companion for...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
No kidding. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I guess that is kind of the thing that they did. And also, I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense in that Martin Landau was, you know, even back then, he was a name. Yeah. You know, I mean, that was a certain amount of star power in Leonard Nimoy because of Star Trek was also a name. So you got to replace him with someone, got to replace Landau with someone who can really fill that role in a sort of like a celebrity sense, you know? Yeah. And Nimoy fit the bill. It makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, I mean, what did you think about Nimoy's performance or Nimoy's character and his performance on the show?
You know, it doesn't necessarily light the world on fire, but he was fun to watch. As a Star Trek fan, it's incredibly difficult to divorce him from the whole Spock thing. It really is. So the first time you see him and he says like, "Hey, baby," or something like that. When he's in character, it's like, "Ah, Spock, what are you doing? Yeah. Why do you have sideburns like that?" He pulls it off. I mean, it's like he's a very natural talent for acting. And so nothing came across as forced. He was a believable character. And, you know, so once you get past the whole Spock thing, you know, it's a good performance.
Yeah, I agree. It is a good performance. And, you know, I agree with you about the whole Spock thing. You know, it is weird to see that. Because especially, like, even more so than with someone like Shatner. Because you see someone like Shatner in something else, let's say on T.J. Hooker or whatever. And it's weird, but it's not so jarring. Because at least he's still playing sort of like an authority figure and everything like that. Yeah. Or extending that even to Boston Legal, you know, it's a comedic role, but, you know, whatever. But with Leonard Nimoy, I mean, Spock is so alien, you know, not just in the, you know, alien sense, but also in just his portrayal of a person.
Yeah.
That when you see him in something like Mission Impossible, where he's actually acting like a human being, you're like, what? That's so weird.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that that's kind of like a big part of it. As far as, you know, having trouble accepting. But there's also this kind of like weird meta thing going on where, like, I get the impression that he was so afraid of being typecast as Spock that sure. He really wanted to do something which was, for one thing, very different, but also allowed him to show his full range of talents. So he's like, okay, I'm going to play this guy who on a weekly basis is playing someone else. And it's like, there you have then in one role, basically he's got a chance on a weekly basis to do something different every single week.
That's a great point. I hadn't even thought of it from that angle, but you're right, because Paris's whole shtick is to be something different every week. So yeah, it does wind up being a showcase. Yeah, spot on.
And it is kind of strange because I watched the first episode that he was in, which was the season 4 premiere, and in that one he had to, I forget exactly what the plot was. I kept on thinking while watching it that it seemed to be sort of it felt like they were trying to basically make him Che. You know, there was like a Central American government which was about to be overthrown, and there were other parties, and basically there were like three guys who were trying to figure out how to divvy up control of the country or whatever, and the makeup and everything that they used and the wardrobe that they gave him and everything, it was like, man, okay, I think almost for sure they were trying to, you know, echo Che when they were doing this.
Sure.
But the weird thing about that, aside from the fact that he was wearing, like, brown face, but, you know.
It was a different era.
It was a different era, yeah. Aside from that, the weird thing about it was, like, this is the first time we've ever seen this character, right? So, you know, Mr. Phelps gets his assignment, and then he goes into the room, and he picks his people, and there's a bunch of characters who I think we have met before because they were holdovers from earlier in the show, and then there's Leonard Nimoy, Paris, and he's like, okay, Paris, so you're going to have to go undercover as this guy. And he's like, okay, I'll do that. And then, like, that's the one time where you actually see him being Paris before he becomes someone else. And it's like, and then for the entire rest of the episode, he is undercover. And it's like, he doesn't have a chance to establish, like, a baseline for who his actual character is. It's like, by the end of the first episode, you are much more familiar with the character that Paris is playing than you are with the character that Nimoy is playing.
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing. I don't know a way around it, aside from doing it like a normal TV show would do and actually introducing a character. But it was the 60s. They didn't do that. I mean, we know that from Star Trek. You just throw people in there and pretend like you've been doing this for the past 5 years already.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think that part of that is the they didn't feel the need for preamble because of the built-in... I mean, because it was season four. You know, they figured people are going to find out who Paris is, you know, as it goes forward. So why bother? Like, you just need to know that he isn't, you know, Che. You know, you need, like, a scene where it's like, he's doing something. Oh, okay. You just need to know it's somebody behind the makeup.
Yeah. Now, as someone who's probably seen more episodes with Nimoy than I have, did you get the impression that there was a character underneath that, or did you feel like he really is just playing someone different each week?
You know, I did get a sense of a character underneath that, because there was a very interesting, you know, especially in the opening of season five, you can definitely pick up on the undercurrents of affection between Paris and I forget Leslie Ann Warren's character name, but whenever he interacts with her, like he plays relationships that maybe weren't even written into the script. Like of all, like if you take Peter Lupus, and who I'm sure is a fine person, he was just delivering lines, as was, God bless him, Peter Graves. But with Nimoy, and you know, to give full credit, Warren and Greg Morris, you very much got a sense of people that were playing characters as opposed to reading lines from a script. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I do think you get that sense of something underneath that you never fully get to know because of the nature of the show.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's kind of a weird thing. Like, that's something which... you never really hear people talk about this, but I don't know. I always think about this when I'm watching the new movies, you know, with Tom Cruise. Is like, part of it is because of the style of those movies and how it's ever changing, which I love. But I really get the impression that if you were to look at each of those movies and say that they were their own things, and each time Tom Cruise is playing a different character, it would totally work that way too. Like if you look at Ethan Hunt in Mission Impossible versus Ethan Hunt, especially in Mission Impossible 2, it's like, where is even the similarity between these two people, you know? And that's not even when he's undercover. It's just in general, it seems like, you know, the actual like characters themselves are very unimportant to this franchise on the whole. I don't know. It's strange.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, like, to sort of expand upon what you said earlier, like, I guess you could look at the movies as full seasons of the show. It's you know, the movies are just binge watching a season of Mission Impossible. So maybe we're looking at seven movies total, and that's when they'll hang it up. I don't know.
Maybe. That'd be cool. What do you think about the movies, you know, since we're on the subject?
They're good. Except for the second one. I don't think anybody really liked the second one.
Oh, man, I love the second one.
Well, there you go. I found you. My long search is over, Mike. I have found the one person. You know, the second one I didn't care for. The third one I liked a lot more than a great deal of my friends did. I love the first one. I remember seeing the first one and thinking it was just, you know, it was the bee's knees, to borrow my grampy's term. And Mission Impossible 4, I thought, I'm not going to lie. I went to go see for the Dark Knight Rises preview, as I think the entire audience did. but, you know, it was entertaining. Like, there's nothing compelling me to go back, but I enjoyed watching it in IMAX. And, you know, when he was on top of the Burj Dubai, that sequence was a lot of fun on IMAX, especially for those of us who have, you know, issues with heights. that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's nothing, you know, much like the show, it's not anything that I'm going to be like, oh, you've got to see Mission Impossible 4. Like, I think somebody would be fine. It's almost like the reverse Star Trek curse. I'm like, yeah, you could watch 1 and 3 and you'll be okay.
Okay. Yeah. And I think my opinion is a bit stronger than yours as far as all of them are concerned. I mean, I was looking forward to the first one so much when I was in high school, and I saw, you know, opening night or the night before or whatever, and I was just like, yeah, that was cool. I don't understand what's going on, but that, yeah, the plane and the helicopter and, you know, flinging on the train and everything. But I really loved the second one. I really loved how they sort of were like, we're going to do something completely different now. You know, we've got a new director in there who has a very distinct style. Just like when you watch the first one, it's like, this is a Brian De Palma movie. It's very much a Brian De Palma movie.
Yeah.
And which is probably truer to the show than any of them, you know, in a sense, at least stylistically. But the second one, it's like, well, we've got John Woo in there. If you hire John Woo to make a movie, you want a John Woo movie. So there's lots of gunfights with, you know, two guns per person. There's doves. It's the whole package, you know, slow motion.
You are not going to sway me on Mission Impossible 2, man. There are so many times I listen to you and I'm like, oh, you know, maybe I'll give it. You're not going to win this battle. Not at all.
Here's the thing about Mission Impossible 2. I mean, I love all that, right? I mean, part of it is nostalgia because it was like the first time that like I got like to show like a big blockbuster summer, you know, Memorial Day kind of movie. And so I was like so looking forward to that and everything. But I have a friend and he would always insist, like when he saw the trailer and everything, he's like, this is going to be the best movie ever made, for sure. And this is the type of guy who, like, if he were to say that, you'd be like, you're just being, you know, sarcastic, you know? Yeah. And then he saw the movie, and he's like, oh, yeah, I saw it. And I'm like, yeah, what'd you think? He's like, it was the best movie ever made. And I'm like, yeah, really? So then what'd you think about it? And he's like, it was the best movie ever made, you know? And to this day, if you ask him what his opinion of it, his opinion of Mission Impossible 2 is, he will say it is the best movie ever made. I have never heard him say anything other than that about Mission Impossible 2. I have no idea if he actually likes it or if he thinks it's the worst thing imaginable.
He's just really committed to the bit at this point. He can't
exactly.
He can't find a way out now.
He can't give it up. But one of the things that you know, he would always bring up, and you know, Max too, and myself, is, you know, he's a really big Hitchcock fan, and Mission Impossible 2, it's got this whole bit which is lifted like almost word for word out of Notorious. I mean, basically the entire plot is like an action version of Notorious, the Alfred Hitchcock movie with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. But it really sort of nails it on the head when there's a scene at a racetrack, which is very, very similar to a scene at a racetrack in Notorious. And we would always talk about that. We're like, it's the best movie ever made. It's, you know, like Notorious, but with gun battles and everything. And which, if Notorious is great, you know, but whatever. But I was at a convention a couple of years ago, a Star Trek convention, and Brandon Braga was up there. And the story by credit for Mission Impossible 2 is given to Ronald D. Moore and Brandon Braga. And so he's up there on stage, and I'm like, now's my chance. And I'm like, hey, Mr. Braga, what exactly was your contribution to Mission Impossible 2? And he's like, I don't even really remember. You know, we would go over to Tom Cruise's house like every day for like 6 months. He was a really cool guy. We talked a lot about Notorious. And I'm like, yes, all right. But with Mission Impossible 3, I mean, I'm on record, and we did a Mission Impossible 3 episode since it was directed by J.J. Abrams and everything, and yeah. I'm on record as saying that I think that movie's amazing. It was my number one movie of 2006, and I really love sort of the meta nature of that in that, you know, it, to me, I see that as like a pair with Alias, where it's like Alias is a show which is, you know, sort of a modern retelling of Mission Impossible, the show. And then when J.J. Abrams makes the leap to the big screen, he basically makes a big budget, big screen version of his television show Alias. And you can kind of look at those two things as a piece and say, like, this is what TV does well, and this is what movies do well, and all that other stuff. I don't know. I think that that movie's awesome. And the fourth one, I think, is, you know, and it's also very much J.J. It's very much J.J. style. And yeah. The fourth one is, you know, I mean, it's kind of hard to tell, but it's very different in that it is a Brad Bird movie, but his action and everything is much more choreographed and sort of old school, almost Spielbergian in nature, and I love that too. And I can't wait for this new one. I can't wait to see what Christopher McQuarrie, who's sort of known for doing like extremely realistic action sequences, what he's going to bring to the table. I think it's going to be awesome. Have you seen the trailer for the new one?
I have seen the trailer for the new one, and it does look rather thrilling. It really does. The thing on top of the plane, Nolan did it, but okay. no,
but this is teasing. You know, you got that thing there where like Tom Cruise is crazy and is like, yeah, I'm gonna do that myself, you know. Yeah. I mean, like, there's this shot which it looks like the most CGI'd shot ever in Mission Impossible 2, where he's having the fight and there's a knife and the two of them are going back and forth with this knife and he ends up in the bottom and Dougray Scott brings the knife down and it stops like a millimeter from Tom Cruise's eyeball, right? I don't know if you remember this shot.
I do.
And you look at that knife and you're like, that's the most CGI knife in the history of CGI or knives, you know? And then you listen to the commentary and they're like, that was a real knife. We actually did that. We attached it to a string and we brought it down, you know, we measured it out. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, what if that's... And everyone else is freaking out, and Tom Cruise is like, no, guys, it's cool. I got this. It's all good. He's a crazy guy. But, you know, more power to him, I have to say.
He's living the dream.
He is living the dream. But, yeah, I don't know. This new movie looks super cool to me. And the thing about it, I don't know what it is about these movies. I don't know why or whatever, but... Like, when I see these trailers, maybe it's just because I'm remembering Mission Impossible 2 and the lead up to that, but, like, I'm just like, I'm all in. Like, this is the movie. Like, someone was just asking me. We were just talking about this on another episode somewhere, and it's like, what movie are you looking forward to most this summer? It's Mission Impossible Rogue Nation for me, without a doubt.
More than Avengers.
More than, absolutely. I'm looking forward to Ant-Man more than Avengers, but, yeah.
Well, that's a topic for another show. Definitely.
Peyton Reed, man. Yeah. Bring it on. Right?
All right.
Bring It On is the best, and you know it.
Oh, Bring It On?
Yeah.
Wait a minute. Oh, my gosh. I didn't even realize. Okay, now I'm looking forward to Ant-Man. Yeah, okay.
You see?
You sold me. Why aren't they playing that up in the ads, man?
I have no idea. Bring It On.
Me.
Down With Love. Have you seen Down With Love?
No, I have not.
Oh, you got to see it. I think you'd like it a lot. Really, really cool movie. But
I'm writing it down like, right now.
It's like a 60s sex comedy kind of thing. And it's shot just like that. Like as if Billy Wilder were to have made a movie in 2003. It's great. Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger. It's hilarious.
Oh, I never saw that. But yeah, okay. Ewan McGregor. Yeah. Yeah, I'll see anything with Ewan McGregor in it. Sure.
And Jerry Ryan's in it. So there you go.
Hey, Star Trek connection.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yes. Anyway, back to Star Trek,
yes.
Whatever. So yes, speaking of Star Trek and Mission Impossible, there is a pretty big connection between the two franchises, which is strange. You know, both of them were developed by Desilu simultaneously as a way to sort of like diversify that company and, you know, take it out of the sitcom world and make it into something more, I'm not going to say legitimate, but more diverse and bigger. And the two of them were both released at the same time. They both began in 1966. And when Star Trek was canceled, that's when Nimoy jumped over to Mission Impossible. So it kind of makes sense. Like, they're like parallel paths. It's almost like, kind of like Worf jumping over to Deep Space Nine after Next Generation ends, in a sense.
Yeah. You know, kind of, but not really. Sure.
Same basic idea. But then, you know, if you look at it, it goes even further because now, you know, in the 90s, they both became fairly successful movie franchises. And then in the aughts, Bad Robot ended up making movies for both of them. And Mission Impossible 3, being J.J. Abrams' first movie, basically has the entire same crew that worked on Star Trek 09 and Star Trek Into Darkness. I mean, down to the production designers and the editors and everything, cinematographers. Mission Impossible 3 is where he assembled his crew, which he then brought over to Star Trek. So even now, to this day, they're still connected, which is pretty cool.
That actually is pretty cool. And given, you know, the other, it's a tiny little property that he's working on for Disney right now. It would appear that Bad Robot and J.J. Abrams are maneuvering to take over the entire entertainment industry.
Yeah.
Because they own a lot of it. So,
and I'm totally okay with that because I think they do great work. I don't know.
Yeah. It's just me. There are worse people that could be at the helm.
Yes.
For sure.
All right. Well, any final thoughts on Mission Impossible or Leonard Nimoy's performance on the show?
Yeah, you know, like we said before, it doesn't really hold up, but that theme song holds up. And, you know, it's fun to go back and sort of see what it was, you know, how things were, especially television-wise. But if you really, really want to bend your mind, okay, in the fifth season, in the episode The Innocent, the guy who played Major Frank Burns on MASH, it plays a Russian guy that they have to foil. And I always forget actors' names, but Major Houlihan, Hot Lips, is in the fourth episode of the season, Homecoming. And if you really want to just trip yourself up, watch The Killer, which is the first episode of season 5, watch The Innocent, which is the third episode of season 5, and then watch Homecoming and say to yourself, what did the same production staff work on these shows? Did they actually know what was happening with this show? What happened here? Like, Homecoming comes out of left field and just has absolutely no place in the Mission Impossible universe. So, you know, do yourself a favor, watch some, you know, something from season 1, 2, 3, 4, and then watch Homecoming from season 5 and just boggle your own mind.
I missed that one, unfortunately, but I'll have to go back and check it out for sure now.
I would love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah. For me, as far as the show itself is concerned, you know, I do think that it is really well done, but I think that it really cannot sustain itself for 171 episodes. I mean, I haven't seen all of those, but I honestly can't imagine watching this because it really does seem like the same thing again and again and again. It's the type of thing where I imagine, you know, if you were to pick out, you know, some of the key episodes which are considered to be the best and, you know, watch those as sort of like a DVD sampler or something like that, that would be a great way to sort of just get a taste of what you're missing so that you can be prepared for these movies, which, you know, while a lot of people complain about them straying from the formula, they're probably better movies than this was a show, if you ask me.
Yeah.
So, in terms of Nimoy's performance, I think that it was a really good choice for him in terms of like a career move, because it really did allow him to do a wide range of stuff, and he's really good doing that stuff. You know, I was always impressed with what I saw. He always sold it to me, which is important, especially since he's playing a guy who is required to sell himself to, you know, the people on the screen.
Yeah.
So that was really cool to me. And it really does sort of just the nature of the role and the fact that he is playing a role inside of a role really sort of makes you look at his performance from like an acting perspective, and really sort of draws attention to how good Nimoy is. So yeah, definitely check out some of his stuff, because it's impressive.
Yeah.
Well, it's been fun talking about Leonard Nimoy's work in Mission Impossible today, but that's not all that we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
It's not an overstatement, and you had said in your introduction that without him and his hand guiding all of this, then it's unlikely that 2 would have been what it was, and if it had not been successful, then it probably would have meant the end of Star Trek at that point.
Earl Grey.
Like, I'm expecting Ricardo Martavan to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5!
The Orb.
Curzon is involved with the Khitomer Quartz. Spock is at Khitomer when those are being talked about, so you would think they would have run into each other.
They probably hung out in the bar together.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out! Now! The Ready Room.
The movie series would not have relaunched and become what it was if not for the amazing bounce of The Wrath of Khan. The Wrath of Khan was to Star Trek the same thing that The Best of Both Worlds was to Next Generation.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, I've always liked the... I like that episode for... I mean, it's one of the most derided of the original series episodes, but yet I always... It has a place in my heart for some reason. I've always enjoyed watching it over. So I wanted to do something with those guys, the Scalbians.
The 602 Club. Like, I could... kind of dismiss Droids in Distress and Fight or Flight and everything like that, and I was just kind of watching the background, but all of a sudden I started catching myself like stopping working and just focusing on watching, and so it just got better and better and better, and I think I was hooked by episode 4, Breaking Ranks. That's when I was like, okay, I like this show, this is good. Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and get in on the Daily Trek Talk. You'll find them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, the Windows Podcast Directory, or you can stream them from the website. Just visit Trek.fm and get all the links over there. Okay, so we had some feedback today, some more feedback.
Hooray.
Yeah.
We love feedback.
Yeah. If you may remember, a couple weeks ago, we got some voicemails from Thomas, who was telling us about Geneviève Bujold's work on Anne of a Thousand Days and talking about, you know, Kate Mulgrew and how good she is. And one of the things which he kind of slipped in there was that he had only seen one episode of Deep Space Nine. And we were like, wait, what?
Yeah.
How does this happen? So so we said, hey, you know, check out some more Deep Space Nine. And he wrote a note back to us. So here's what he says. He says, "Guy who sent the two emails last week appreciated you including me in the podcast. We'll take your advice to give DS9 another shot. What I watched so far, pilot from the original broadcast." Okay, that's actually a good place to start with that. It is. You know, some of the shows, I mean, like, I would never recommend that with Next Gen. I would never recommend Encounter at Farpoint being your first.
Yeah. <It's>, but,
but like Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and Enterprise, I would say, like, yeah, watch the pilots first. That makes sense. Little Green Men. Greg Cox is my favorite Star Trek novelist, and his Eugenics Wars Volume 2 refers to this episode. I hated it. Most things involving the Ferengi, although Voyager's episode with them was a great story. I don't know, do you remember Little Green Men? That's the one where...
Roswell, right?
Yeah. That, I can understand hating it. I personally like it, but the thing about that episode is, like, it tries to do a thing. It tries to do a comedy bit. It's not your typical DS9. It does show sort of, like, how far away from the norm DS9 is willing to get, both in terms of tone and, like, story and style and everything.
Yeah.
But, like, I could see someone sitting there watching that being like, this is stupid. I do not think that it is at all representative of Deep Space Nine on the whole, you know?
I agree. I that specific episode, I wound up comparing actually with Futurama when they went back to Roswell, and nothing can really hold a candle to that tour de force. So the Ferengi or no Zoidberg.
Yes, this is true. This is true. But the thing about the Ferengi, you know, he says that he hates the Ferengi. I can understand hating the Ferengi, okay? Because they are annoying, and lots of times they come across as sort of, like, grating. But the thing that Deep Space Nine does is there are episodes which are just sort of like, you're just like, oh, my God. Like the one, the Some Like It Hot ripoff thing. I forget the name of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's some of those where you're just like, I can't believe you guys are doing this, really. But the thing about Deep Space Nine and the way that they dealt with the Ferengi was every once in a while, sort of in the middle of this, they would throw in something really profound. You know, like Ira Stephen Baer, who ran Deep Space Nine, he loved the Ferengi because of basically how they were representative of humans. And there were times where they would, you know, just throw little things in there where it just makes you kind of stop and think about it.
Yeah.
And like there's one part where I forget where it was, where basically the Ferengi are doing something stupid and Sisko or someone is like, my God, the Ferengi, oh my God. You know, they're doing the same thing that we as an audience do, right?
Yeah.
But then Quark stops and says something along the lines of, like, you think we're so primitive because, you know, we have weird quirks and, you know, we are obsessed with money and everything like that. But we never went to, like, war with each other. We never killed millions of our own kind because of petty disputes or anything like that. So you tell me, who's the more evolved species? And, like, stuff like that is actually kind of cool. It's buried. It's kind of few and far between, you know, when they do that type of stuff. But it's stuff like that. And also, I think, sort of like the earnestness of Armin Shimerman's performance.
Yeah.
That really sort of, because if you talk to Armin Shimerman about it, and, you know, you're like, oh man, you were so funny on Deep Space Nine or whatever, even though he was extremely funny and you can tell that he was playing a comic role and everything like that, he'll be like, what are you talking about? I was being completely serious. That's how I played it. And I think that, you know, while he was doing that or whatever, he took that character so seriously. Yeah. That's what made it work.
I agree. I completely agree. I think that Deep Space Nine, I think that the Ferengi were a misstep in Next Generation. In Deep Space Nine, thanks to Quark, And even thanks to, you know, Nog and Rom and his interactions with them, they become really interesting. I think that it's possible that Little Green Men is, since it is such a weird offbeat episode, it's not the best one to recommend the Ferengi further. You do need to see some of, like, Who Mourns for Morn in season 6.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Quark, you know, has quite the role in that. And, you know, you find out those little moments where you find out that Quark has a heart, that he is the way he is, you know, in terms of business and everything, because of a sort of a sense of cultural obligation. But when you strip it down, you know, even his devotion to Jadzia is legitimate. You know, he may put on airs about everything, but he legitimately cared for her and was willing to go with Worf to, you know, commend her soul to Stovakor and everything. And it's like, that's not, you know, it shows a heart, a reality about the character and the Ferengi as a whole that is not always apparent.
Yeah, definitely true. Thomas continues. He saw the Trials and Tribulations in the TAS Tribble 1, the animated series Tribble episode. So he's seen that, which is good. That would have been the first thing I would have recommended for him as a TOS fan. And he saw whatever DS9 content Enterprise used, which I don't think was anything. I'm not exactly sure. He continues, my query, isn't DS9 a sequential series versus episodic? I can't watch 9 seasons, but perhaps you can suggest 8 to 10 that would turn me into a fan who wants more. I heard the Cardassian War was done extremely well. It's basically Quark and Odo that turned me away. The Ferengi are like the greedy Jar Jars of the universe, and René Auberjonois reminds me of Benson or whatever old sitcom he starred in. He did a fantastic reading of Cox's second volume, though. Anyone who loves Khan should read those, then To Reign in Hell. By the way, Professor Tenuto had great comments, as well as Cushman. Okay, so...
I do want to say I agree with the comments about the Eugenics Wars books. Those were fantastic.
You've read them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I really enjoyed them.
See, I haven't read them, but the thing which I always bring up, which I always think is weird, is like I remember like when I worked with Max, there was one point where he had them. There was like a week where he was reading both of them, and which is weird in and of itself because it's like Max is reading a Star Trek book. That doesn't happen, you know. and then you know, I'm like, hey, you read those books, you know, are they good? And he's like, yeah, they're actually pretty good. And that just, like, blew my hair back. I'm like, what? You read a Star Trek book and you liked it? This thing must be, like, the best book ever written. Is this, like, better than, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird or something like that? I don't know. So...
I wouldn't go that far, but they're definitely worth reading.
Okay. It's good to know. I have to check them out. But as far as what to watch from Deep Space Nine, I mean, we'll put together a list and we'll email it to you of, you know, 8 to 10 episodes, because I think that's a good idea. It is sequential versus episodic in that there is a continuing storyline and things change. And unlike Mission Impossible, you can't just, you know, pick up a random episode wherever and it won't matter. Like, the show, the storyline progresses throughout the show, but inside of that, you can pretty much watch any single episode and get a complete story from that, which you can appreciate on its own. You know, it's just a much more rewarding experience when you watch the whole thing from the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, a good example of that is actually all the way in season 7, Shadows and Symbols.
Mm-hmm.
You can watch that alone. But it does go a great distance toward advancing Sisko's character development toward the end of the show.
Yeah.
Like pointing him in that final direction. But you can watch that as a standalone. I would recommend watching something from an earlier season first. And like you said, we'll put like a list together and everything. But along the way, you're absolutely right. There are ones you can pick up that, they contribute to the whole, but they're not dependent on the mythology. Like X-Files had a mythology, but there were still episodes you could pick up and watch that would plug in when you later went back and rewatched something that you taped, but in the moment didn't matter what the mythology was.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I had to recommend just a couple episodes for you to give you a good sense of what to watch, and this is for everyone, not just Thomas, but anyone out there who may have not jumped into Deep Space Nine yet, because it is a daunting task. I would say maybe something early on, since you've already seen the pilot, the first three episodes of season two are kind of like a three-parter. Like a Homecoming, The Circle, and The Siege. That's a pretty solid little three-part arc right there. I would definitely recommend those. Jumping ahead to like the first episode of season four, they did like a two-hour long episode where they introduced Worf, and that was called Way of the Warrior.
And it's a really good, really good story.
Yeah, and it really kind of like it was obviously designed to be sort of like a good entry point to the show, because the whole point of bringing Worf on was to get more viewers who hadn't been watching it, and it's also sort of like the point where the show really, you know, just kicks into, you know, high gear and just is off and running for the rest of the series. Those two, but if you want like two little examples of like things that this show does where it's just like almost a TOS in nature, in that, you know, it's like a little self-contained story where it's just telling like a really good story with a really good message or whatever. There's one which is really outside of the box in terms of like the style or whatever, and that's Far Beyond the Stars, which is almost like Sitting on the Edge of Forever type of episode, in that it all takes place in the past and everything, where basically there's a question about whether or not Deep Space Nine even exists, or whether or not Sisko is actually a writer in the 50s who is writing all of this as a story for a science fiction magazine. And there's a lot of stuff in there which is sort of like about what the culture of, America in general, but science fiction writing very specifically was like at that point in time in sort of the 50s and all of the prejudices that were involved and everything like that. That's a really good episode. It's almost like an episode of The Twilight Zone. And the other episode, which everyone recommends, is In the Pale Moonlight, so that you can see just how dark this show can get and how unflinching it is in its portrayal and honesty when it comes to like war and the things that, you know, good people need to do in order to make sure that evil doesn't win, or, you know, maybe they shouldn't be doing. It's a very interesting philosophical episode. It's considered to be one of the best because it's so incredibly dark. But it has kind of a weird style to it. It's not very straightforward. It's all told in flashback. Mm-hmm. Like after the events occurred, Sisko is narrating them into his captain's log, and it's very cool and very dark, and I would definitely recommend that one too. That's our recommendations. I love you know, telling people which Star Trek episodes they should watch, you know.
It is a lot of fun. I really like the ones you've recommended. I would tack on to there, because I do think you can watch it on its own, is Inquisition, which I believe is in season six. Section 31.
Yes. Oh,
and
yeah.
That's where that, and you know, I always forget again the actor's name, but
William Sadler.
Yes, him from Die Hard 2. Yes. He's awesome.
Yes, the guy who turns the TV off with the remote control.
While
he's naked at the beginning of Die Hard 2 to show that he's a badass. That guy.
Yes, that guy. So I definitely recommend Inquisition. And I do think, and I'm surprised you overlooked this one, because it truly is a standalone, even though it is in Season 7, Take Me Out to the Holosuite.
I didn't forget. I mean, that's one of my favorites. If you're a baseball fan, definitely check out Take Me Out to the Holosuite. If you're not a baseball fan, I think that it's a great episode, right, for a lot of reasons. But since Thomas said he was not a fan of Little Green Men, I wasn't going to go that far out on a limb and recommend Take Me Out to the Holosuite. But I do love that episode.
I'm not a huge baseball fan, but I think it's a terrific just a terrific example of everything about Star Trek is about teamwork and focusing on what's important versus, you know, winning and achievement and those sorts of, like, focusing on what's important. And I really think that Take Me Out to the Holosuite is a great example of an episode where the characters actually learn, you know, that sometimes it's just the love of the game that keeps you going. You know, you don't need all of the trappings and don't get caught up in that. I think the message of the episode is wonderful.
I love that episode, you know, with all my heart. But I was skeptical about recommending that to Thomas for fear of turning him off of all of Deep Space Nine. Watch that one after you've watched some of these others.
After you've gotten to know the rest of the crew. Fair point.
But yeah. If anyone else has any suggestions for Thomas or anything, let us know. Email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter @comtrackstars and any of those things. You can find a little tab to send us a message on the side of our show page, or you can send a voicemail like Thomas did. There's a link on Trek FM to that as well. You could also talk to us on Facebook at the Babel Conference. Just type in B-A-B-E-L conference in Facebook and send us a request, and we'll let you in and talk about some Star Trek. There's lots of ways for you to get in touch with us. John, how can people get in touch with you, and what else are you doing on the internet these days?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. And I'm also on a little podcast called Words with Nerds that I appear on with my friend Craig that airs on Thursdays, iTunes, Podbean, et cetera, and so forth.
Excellent. And you can find me right here on Trek FM doing Standard Orbit with Drew. And you can also find me on CommentaryTrackStars.com, where I do Commentary Track Stars Off Topic with Max and Brandon, and check those shows out as well. You know, I don't know, it's weird. I mean, like, Words with Nerds, you guys do that on a weekly basis. Yep. Commentary Track Stars, I do that on a weekly basis, and yet, like, only like a third of the people who listen to this show listen to those shows, where it's like, we're just talking about, like, other nerdy stuff that's not Star Trek. Come on, give us a listen, you know?
We don't bite.
What's the worst that could happen? Maybe you'll hear some profanity, whatever. You guys have heard that
We don't
before.
Work blue on Words with Nerds, my friend.
All right, go listen to Words with Nerds. And for all of you...
for the more adult audiences, go to Commentary Tracks. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Well, before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary Trek Stars to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read but never thought you'd have the time for. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks, with over 150,000 titles to choose from and new titles coming every week. From classics to current bestsellers and even some of the most famous Star Trek books, like Prime Directive, Federation, or even Greg Cox's Eugenics Wars books, Audible has something for everyone. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice, along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. So give it a try today. Catch up on all those classic Star Trek books you've yet to read and that latest novel from your favorite author as well. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. And finally, one last way that you can support us is by becoming a patron of the network on patreon.com. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm and sign up today. You can, there's various levels of donation where you can get various cool rewards, kind of like Kickstarter, but on a monthly basis. And we would appreciate anything that you could give us over there to help us keep our shows going. Just go to patreon.com/trekfm and you'll get all the info over there. All right. Well, that's one Leonard Nimoy show in the can. We've got two more left. Neither of them are dramatic works, but both of them are shows in which he was a host. So we'll be dealing with those in the next couple weeks. The first of which is In Search Of.
Yeah.